Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a recent study testing theories of American politics, elites, interest groups, and average citizens that finds the U.S. is dominated by a rich and powerful elite and that the majority of Americans have little influence over the policies our government adopts. The co-author of the study, Martin Gillens, a professor of politics at Princeton University, whose research examines representation, public opinion, and mass media, especially in relation to inequality in public policy, joins us to discuss how, if the economic elite support a policy change, it has a 50-50 chance of being enacted, while if they oppose a policy, its chances of becoming law are less than 20%. Then we'll examine the takeover of Russia's equivalent of Facebook, VKontakte, by cronies of Vladimir Putin, forcing its founder, Pavel Durov, to flee Russia and declare that, unfortunately, the country is incompatible with internet business at the moment. Stephen Wilson, a doctoral student in political science at the University of Wisconsin, who teaches Russian politics and foreign policy, especially the effects of the internet and new communications technology on Russian politics, joins us to discuss Putin's move to first have friendly oligarchs buy up the internet, then for the state to totally control its content, as the Chinese do. Then finally, Jesse Katz joins us in the studio. He is a former Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the Los Angeles Times, who is now a contributing writer at Los Angeles Magazine, where his latest article is featured, Escape from Cuba, Yasiel Puig's Untold Journey to the Dodgers. We will discuss the dramatic odyssey of the L.A. Dodgers star baseball player's fifth and final escape from Cuba into the hands of Mexican smugglers with ties to the murderous Zethus cartel, to Puig's $42 million contract with the Los Angeles Dodgers, a financial home run that many colorful characters involved in this shady saga are now laying claim to. And joining us now is Martin Gillens, who's a professor of politics at Princeton University, whose research examines representation, public opinion, and mass media, especially in relation to inequality and public policy. He's the author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, and Why Americans Hate Welfare, Race, Media, and the Politics of Anti-Poverty Policy. His latest study with Benjamin Page is Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens. Welcome to Background Briefing, Martin Gillens.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
And so much talk about an American oligarchy, of the growing disparity in the income gap, the wealth gap in America. All of this seems to be out there in the political zeitgeist and may well intensify in terms of a debate as the November elections approach. But I guess in a sense, your study is not just saying that the U.S. is dominated by a rich and powerful elite. It actually gets into the weeds, does it not, with 1,779 survey questions asked between 1981 and 2002 on these public policy issues that we're about to discuss.
Yes, that's right. We've spent quite a bit of time collecting an enormous amount of data, and with the help of many assistants, I should say. And the data covers this about 25-year period and really allows us to show, I think, for the first time, the relative ability of different groups or kinds of actors in this country to influence what our government does.
And in terms of the takeaway, the headline, my sense is that what you've shown here is that the majorities of the American public actually have little influence over policies our government adopts, but more specifically, if the economic elite in this country wants to push a policy or back a policy, it's basically got a 50-50 chance of succeeding in becoming law. And if our economic elite opposes any given measure or policy, that its chances of becoming law are less than 20%, in fact, 18%. So am I focusing on what you're delivering here?
Yes, no, that's exactly right. And I should point out that the actors that we show have influence over government policymaking include both affluent individuals, who we call economic elites, and organized interest groups, which primarily represent the business community. And you're quite right that when either of those, either the elite individuals, the wealthy individuals, or organized interests favor a policy change, that we find that that's much more likely to occur than when they oppose that policy change. But when ordinary Americans, who we measure by the sort of middle class, people at the 50th income percentile, their preferences on those same sets of policies seem to make essentially no difference in the likelihood of it being adopted or not.
So, in effect, the rich exercise a veto.
Yes, I think that's a reasonable way to put it. They don't always get what they want because we have a very sort of status quo-oriented political system, right? Our checks and balances and multiple veto points and so on does prevent even powerful interests from getting what they want much of the time. And yet it makes a big difference whether they favor or oppose some policy, and it makes, as I say, essentially no difference whether the middle class favors or opposes a policy.
So why is it then that you don't use the O word, the oligarchy? I mean, you seem to prefer the phrase economic elite domination.
That's true. In the media coverage of our work, the appeal of that term seems to be irresistible, but it's not a term that we use in the paper. And while different people mean different things by oligarchy, to me, it kind of conjures up this image of a very small number of extraordinarily wealthy and powerful individuals, kind of pulling the strings. And I don't really think that's what's going on here. I think in America, influence over government is more widespread than that. It may not reach as far down, really, as the top 10%, maybe not even the top 1%, but it's not a few dozen, rich people. And so we don't use the word oligarchy, and in fact are sort of hesitant at identifying any individual sort of subset of affluent Americans as those who have the power. Right? I think it's fair to say that the more money, the more resources a person has, the better able they are to shape political outcomes. But it's kind of a gradual, shading into less and less influence. And then by the time you get down to the middle class, as we find, there's essentially no ability or no responsiveness of government policymakers to the preferences of Americans at average income levels.
Well, it seems, though, that there's been for the longest time these conspiracy questions. I mean, I guess Hofstadter wrote a book about the paranoid style of American politics that's always suggested that there have been these shadowy elites, that the world is controlled by five white men in a back room somewhere, mm-hmm. Whether they be the Bilderbergers or the Trilateral Commission, et cetera. And that's been a sort of staple amongst the conspiracy theorists on the far left and the far right. But in effect, it looks like that the conspiracy theory version of reality is not so far off the mark, albeit not with mythical groups like Bilderbergers and Trilateralists, but with, describe this elite, if you will.
First let me say that my co-author in this work, Ben Page, is trying to get a much better sense of what truly wealthy Americans want and how they go about influencing the political system to get it. And the data that we have suggests that people at the top of the income distribution, but nevertheless, people who are captured by ordinary surveys, so these are not billionaires, maybe not even millionaires, although they may share many of the same views as those sort of more affluent and wealthy individuals. And it's this somewhat larger group of people that we have data on and that we show the preferences exerting an influence over government policymaking. So in our work, it's really a considerably larger set of individuals, and we don't really know to what degree they are themselves influencing government and to what degree they share the preferences of a smaller set of more affluent individuals. But as a group, it's very clear that once you start getting below the top of the income distribution, that influence falls off very quickly. Now, it is important to point out that there are many issues in which the middle class and the affluent share preferences. And on those sorts of issues, the prospects of the middle class getting what it wants is the same as the prospects for the affluent. So it's not that middle-class Americans never see the policies that they want adopted by their government. But what is the case is that whether they want those policies or not seems not to make much difference in what the government does.
So it's just the confluence of some policies that between the elite and the middle class.
That's correct. And I believe that that's why a considerable body of work in political science has interpreted its findings as showing the influence of middle-class Americans. That is, they've measured what average citizens want and related that to what the government does, but without taking into account the role of elites and interest groups. And so there's a false perception of influence that once you take those other actors into account, you see really fades away.
Well, isn't that the inherent dilemma that the modern Democratic Party has? It gets its votes from ordinary middle class and working Americans, but gets its money from the elite?
Yes, that's true. And to some degree, it's true for the Republican Party as well. Not as much, but especially on social issues, the Republican Party tries to appeal to lower income Americans. But as you suggest, it's really both parties that are dependent on the wealthy for the money that makes the political system run.
So is then the Koch brothers, is that our tendency just to simplify things, you know, in the way that I mentioned the Bilderbergers and the Trilateralists, that the Koch brothers have become the new brand catchphrase for America's elite?
Well, it's certainly convenient to have, an enemy, if you will, that you can clearly identify. But I do think it's more complicated than that. And not to in any way diminish the power of people like the Koch brothers, which I do think is enormous and quite problematic. But nevertheless, that it's not some small group of wealthy individuals alone who are shaping what government does. Politicians, office holders, presidential candidates spend enormous amounts of time trying to raise money from not a huge number of people and not, for the most part, ordinary Americans, but nevertheless from a much broader range of wealthy individuals who have an interest in politics. So it's not just the sort of few people who grab the headlines. It's a somewhat larger group than that.
But it seems like when it comes to the crunch, the middle class are shut out, and the poor who don't tend to vote are totally shut out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just in closing then, Martin Gillins, what is your expectation of, I mentioned in this current sort of context with inequality being out there in the political zeitgeist and likely to intensify as we get towards the November elections, do you think this is an important moment in America to debate? Even if you don't want to use the O word, oligarchy, at least we should be talking about the extent to which we are still a democracy and have become an oligarchy.
I completely agree, and that's why I'm so delighted that the paper that Ben and I wrote has generated so much interest. Whether people want to attach the word oligarchy to it or not, as I'm not especially concerned about, but I think that public debate about this issue is terribly important, and it's really only extraordinary pressure from large numbers of Americans and perhaps allies among the well-to-do that can bring about the kinds of changes, campaign finance reform and so on, that would be needed to make the American government more equally responsive to all of its citizens.
So how would we get hold? How do our listeners get hold of your study?
They can go to my webpage at Princeton University and follow the links there, or to Ben Page at the Political Science Department at Northwestern University. And we both have links to the paper, which will be published this coming fall in Perspectives on Politics, a political science journal.
And, of course, there's an article by John Cassidy at The New Yorker about your study, Is America an Oligarchy? And the BBC has also been covering it as well. So it's out there in the zeitgeist too, right?
Absolutely. I'm happy to say that there's probably a couple dozen different options on the web for people interested in our work.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Martin Gillins.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Martin Gillins, who's a professor of politics at Princeton University, whose research examines representation, public opinion, and mass media, especially in relation to inequality in public policy. He's the author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, and Why Americans Hate Welfare, Race, Media, and the Politics of Anti-Poverty Policy. His latest study with Benjamin Page is Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens. We're going to take a brief station break and be looking into Vladimir Putin's takeover of Russia's equivalent of Facebook. What have we done? Have we get so far from the sun? Lost in an oscillating phase where a tiny few catch all of the rays. All of our working days are done, but a tiny few are having all of the fun. Get used to the dust. 100%. Don't get error. Be careful with the downloading. Protect your eyes. Protect yourself from digital decay. Digital decay. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Wilson, who's a doctoral student in political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he teaches courses on post-communist and Russian politics and Russian foreign policy, with a focus on the effects of the Internet and new communications technologies on politics in Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Wilson.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And the head of VKontakte, which is Russia's equivalent of Facebook, he has left the country. Now he's saying that he's out of Russia and has no plans to go back. And quoting him, unfortunately, the country is incompatible with internet business at the moment. What do you take that to mean?
There's a couple different levels there. The first is Mr. Durov's personal situation vis-a-vis the Russian regime. And the second is the more general statement he's making about internet companies in Russia right now. On the personal level, Mr. Durov has experienced a little bit of repression from the Russian regime in particular. There's been a couple of incidents that have been reported where police raided his personal home and such, and that was the sparking event for him getting out of the country. So it definitely seems that it's been a good idea for him personally to get as far from the regime as possible, just judging on his personal experiences. Speaking of the more general issues that Russia is having with its internet companies, there's been an expansive effort over the last year or two of a consolidation of different Russian media companies, particularly internet media companies, under the guise of a few different large companies controlled by oligarchs that have very strong ties with Vladimir Putin and the Russian regime. So he's pretty well dead on with his description of Russia not being particularly friendly at the moment towards internet business.
Well, specifically, his company, VKontakte, which is the equivalent of Facebook, and I think it's probably the biggest internet company. And I don't, whether you recall, a while back, Durov, I think, offered Edward Snowden a job there. But, you know, it looks as if the two billionaires that have taken over VKontakte are the richest oligarch of all, Usmanov of MailRU and many other enterprises, as well as Putin's close ally and former chief of staff, who is now the head of Rosneft, a big oil company, Igor Seshin. He's the minority owner now. So you've got two oligarchs basically who've taken over Durov's company. Did he have any say in the matter?
Not in particular. Durov, towards the end, only had about 12% holding in the company. He had two original investors, angel investors, both Russian, controlled about 48% of the company, and they sold their 48% last year to United Capital, which is owned and controlled by Putin's man. The events of the last few months have been geared towards getting control over just another few percent, so that way they had control over the company. And the way they accomplished that was that Mail.ru had owned 40% of VK for quite some time. So once those original angel investors sold their 48% out, essentially Duroff was basically cut out of control of the company at that point. So he had still had 12%, but the other 88 were controlled by friends of the regime anyway. So when he sold his shares finally here in the last month or two, I think that was just an acknowledgement of, I'm not in control anymore. I might as well get money for it, since I can't have any control anymore.
So, but Durov's had problems with the Putin regime for some time, and it appears that he has stuck his neck out in resisting pressure from the Kremlin in terms of them wanting to censor VK.com, VKontakte, which is, the big Facebook equivalent in Russia. He's clashed with the Russian authorities, you know, because he's offering a forum for activists to organize protests against Putin. And he also refused to take down the blog of the anti-corruption figure in Russia who came in second in the recent mayoral elections in Moscow, Alexei Navalny. Now it looks like the regime now is moving against Navalny, as well as having taken over VK. They're moving against Navalny on a trumped-up libel charge based upon a tweet that he sent, which then would, since he's on probation from another trumped-up charge of a stealing lumber, he will probably spend some time in jail.
Yeah, Durov was first stuck his neck out, at least publicly, in 2011 when Russia had the fairly large mass protests in Moscow and St. Petersburg over the results of the parliamentary election that clearly had been fairly significantly rigged, at least in the cities. VKontakte was used widely for the opposition to organize their meetings and opposition activities. And the Kremlin actually ordered Durov to take down several of the opposition activists' accounts. And he publicly refused and, in fact, posted put up a picture of his dog wearing a hoodie with his official response to the request. With regard to Navalny, it's a little bit more complicated. Navalny doesn't have, or he has a VKontakte account, but his blog and such is all hosted over on LiveJournal, which Durov never had any authority to take down at all. The interesting thing, though, is that LiveJournal has, in fact, been exposed to a very similar process of being taken over by allies from the Kremlin. LiveJournal used to be an American company. It was founded in Southern California and sort of dissipated in importance in the Western world, sort of like MySpace and other such early social media companies. But for whatever reason, LiveJournal latched on to Russians. And so the majority of Russian bloggers blog on LiveJournal. And several years ago, the entire company was 100% bought out by SUP Media, which is a wholly owned Russian media company that is controlled by guys with ties to the FSB and to the Putin regime also. So,
and the FSB being the state security apparatus.
Yeah.
So, and that happened in 2007. So what's the logic then of controlling this very popular blogging site, LiveJournal? Is the idea is that they've got all of the dissidents under one roof that they can watch them?
I think that might be the long-term plan. The catch is that doing things like actively electronically monitoring all internet activity and seeing what the opposition is doing en masse, sort of like how China does, that's something that takes a lot of technical capacity by the state and by the regime. And while Russia seems to be maneuvering the pieces such that it physically and financially controls the assets that people are using for social media, we haven't actually seen any evidence yet of the regime being able to do the sort of things like China has been doing, which is sort of the thing that's always in the back of our heads when a non-democratic regime starts kind of gobbling up the internet companies and trying to control the internet more and more. Not saying that the Putin regime is not going to do that, just that we haven't seen evidence that they've had the capacity to do that yet.
But the owners of Lie Journal, these, you know, SVR guys and FSB guys, Putin's cronies, they've already blocked the site a number of times when Navalny's verdict was read. They blocked the site and they put up a sign saying planned maintenance. And they've also blocked Navalny's blog, have they not?
They have, but it's sort of curious the way that they've done it. Live Journal itself has been taken down with denial of service attacks several times over the years, in conjunction with when large political events were happening in Russia. So the type of thing that has plausible deniability, but is too much to be coincidence. There's only been one time that in general Live Journal has been shut down, which was for the Navalny verdict last year. Every other time it has been sort of subtle and behind the scenes. In the last couple of months, Navalny's blog in particular, so not Live Journal, but just Navalny.livejournal.com, was ordered taken down, but it was only taken down for approximately 24 hours, and then it was back up again. And so that's been sort of something interesting that the regime has been doing, is they expanded the capacity of the general prosecutor's office to actually issue internet ban orders on URLs, which previous to a couple of months ago, that was strictly the regime of what amounts to their FBI and their drug police, and was generally used for sort of legitimate complaints against criminal operations. It's only been in the last couple of months that they've started issuing those ISP-level bans on actual political websites. And interestingly enough, Navalny was targeted, but again, only for 24 hours. And there's been a lot of other opposition websites, though, that have been sort of permanently targeted, where they're still on the list, and anytime somebody puts up a proxy that links to it, a shutdown order is put up for that proxy URL. So there's something interesting going on with the way they're approaching Navalny in particular with that regard.
Well, but Putin has also moved, or his surrogates have moved to take over what was left of the mainstream media's opposition, very, very small as it was, a cable television network and Echo Moscow, the radio network, that have been the only sources of uncensored news in Russia, along with the newspaper Novaya Gazeta, which I take it the reason that Putin doesn't shut that one down is, one, it's one of the main shareholders is Gorbachev, but number two, I think he wants to have at least one token newspaper to prove that there is freedom of the press, right? What's your reading on that? Why, having moved after and closed everything else down, why has he not closed down Novaya Gazeta?
I think because he needs, like you were saying, he needs to have some token opposition, but in addition to more than it just being token opposition, he's smart enough to realize there's going to be some opposition no matter what he does. And so if he knows exactly where and how the opposition is organizing, it's a lot better to just leave that up than it is to crack down on it and have it spread to a dozen different websites that they have no physical or financial control over, for instance.
So that's why in 2007, his friends at SUP Media took over Live Journal.
That's my read on it, is that there's sort of two things in play. The one is the optimism from the Putin regime, not from our point of view in all likelihood, that in the long run he can build the sort of apparatus that the Chinese have, doing active monitoring and really active control of political dialogue. But at least in the short run, it sort of operates as a trump card if there is a political crisis. So if there's a political crisis where you have hundreds of thousands of people in the streets and there's real concern about the regime falling, and he actually has in his hands the ability to pull the plug on communications, it's something he can only do once, because once he does it, people aren't going back to that communications medium. They'll scatter to the Facebooks and the Twitters and the various foreign sources of social media that work just as well, but they're outside of the regime's control. So he doesn't want to use it unless he has to, but he has it, and it might make the difference at some point.
So what's your, I mean, for an American audience to understand the significance of the takeover of VK.com, VK.com, which is the equivalent of Facebook, that it would be extraordinary if the U.S. government took over Facebook and then had access to all of the, billion people that are posting stuff on it. What has been the response in Russia, do you know?
The response has been relatively muted. There's a lot of cynicism in Russia when I talk to people that are in Russia, and there's been a growing cynicism for a very long time about their regime and about the chances for meaningful democracy evolving in any way under this regime. And I think they really just sort of see these things as nails in the coffin more than anything else. They're unsurprised by it, and it just seems like incremental steps that seem obvious in retrospect.
So Durov now has fled the country, the founder of VKontakte, VK.com. I assume he's in England, and it hasn't been revealed where he is, but that's my guess. What did you make of, given that Durov a while back offered Edward Snowden a job, and then Edward Snowden suddenly appeared recently on this love fest that Putin does once a year, where it's a call-in show and it's highly orchestrated, and the giddy hostess says, "We've got a big surprise for you, Vladimirovich. We have Edward Snowden." And then Snowden came on and asked the extraordinarily softball question whether there is Russian censorship, their censorship of the media or people's personal phones and internets, etc., as has been the same question in effect that was asked of Clapper by Senator Wyden here in the United States, which Clapper lied about, of course. But in Russia, Putin says, man to man, as one intelligence officer to another, I can tell you that we're looking for terrorists, but we don't have these broad sweeping capacities. I mean, give me a break. What's your sense then of what's going on there with Edward Snowden?
I think Snowden is a very interesting figure. I think he's invaluable historically because he got out with information that I think the public needed to know. The flip side of that is he played out sort of as a fool of circumstance with his fleeing from the country, going to Russia, and it's sort of the doing one good thing in a bad way doesn't then make up for a succession of just sort of doing very stupid, naive things, which is what I think we've seen ever since then. I think that basically anything Snowden says can be safely discounted in terms of his conversations about Russia. I think Putin scored a fairly decent PR victory by getting Snowden into the country and kind of being able to have this American figure that says nice things about him and the internet and such, but I don't think it really means anything. I don't think Snowden is providing any actual critical or honest appraisals about what's going on. I think he basically sits in the dark and he's told things, and he may or may not believe them or not, but I don't think any information coming from him at this point is anything more than a part of a PR apparatus that's going on in the Kremlin.
Well, just in closing, I get lots of mail from people saying I should be talking to Stephen Cohen all the time about what's happening in Ukraine, to get the Russian point of view, and basically most of the complaints are that America is really the evil country and that we're misunderstanding Russia. I don't know what one can do to point out the obvious, that this guy is a thug and a gangster. He's stolen billions, and he's completely rigged the judiciary, and now he's completely eliminated all press freedom. I mean, what more evidence do people need to know that this guy isn't, you know, the friend of the Russian people or the friend of anybody else for that matter?
I, I think, sadly, at some point, evidence doesn't matter. I think people take on these beliefs based on a lot of what their identity says about the way they think the world should work and does work. And at some point, a lot of political issues simply become issues of faith rather than issues of evidence, where they believe that this guy is this sort of figure and any evidence presented to the contrary must be engineered. And once you've sort of taken on that point of view about something, then it doesn't matter what evidence is brought to you because you've already discounted the possibility of the evidence mattering. So that's probably a very cynical point of view that applies to all branches of politics, but this one in particular.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Stephen Wilson.
Well, thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Wilson, who's a doctoral student in political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he teaches courses in post-communist and Russian politics and Russian foreign policy, with a focus on the effects of the Internet and new communications technologies on politics in Russia. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jesse Katz about his article in Los Angeles Magazine, Escape from Cuba, Yasiel Puig's Untold Journey to the Dodgers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Jesse Katz, who is a contributing writer at Los Angeles Magazine and the author of The Opposite Field. A former Los Angeles Times staff writer, he has earned numerous honors over a three-decade career, including two Pulitzer Prizes for Spot News Reporting and the Penn Center USA Award for Literary Journalism. His latest article featured in the Los Angeles Magazine is Escape from Cuba, Yasiel Puig's Untold Journey to the Dodgers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jesse Katz.
Ian, it is really nice to be with you.
And this is an amazing story, and of course, it's an open-ended one, right? I don't know where to begin, and I'm sure as a writer, you didn't know where to begin with the story.
This isn't sports talk radio, right?
No, this is not. This is news analysis. So I'm more interested in the politics of this as opposed to how many home runs he's hit. But I get it that he's incredibly popular. And that he put the Dodgers back on the map, right?
Right. I mean, it is part of the story, the fact. I mean, if he was a mediocre player in the major leagues and had gone through this, we probably wouldn't be spending as much time talking about him. The fact that he is physically, exceptional and plays with this kind of emotional exuberance and fearlessness and does boneheaded things out on the field as well. That's just part of the mystique and the reason why people are so fascinated by him.
Right. Well, we don't expect our athletes to be rocket scientists, though, do we?
If we did, we have a long history of being disappointed. I mean, you know, one good starting point is you know, it's so tempting to want to view baseball through this kind of nostalgic lens, right? We think it's our bucolic national pastime. And, you know, if you pay attention to baseball at all, you know that it's always reflecting what's going on in society. It's never something separate. It's always enmeshed in the politics and the social issues and, of course, the economics of our world today. And what this story really is, it's a story about a black market for baseball players. It's about this illicit pipeline, these smugglers and investors who are hiring the smugglers who are – they're exploiting – the chasm between these two countries, the United States and Cuba, and this dysfunctional relationship that has existed, you know, for my entire lifetime.
Right, outlasting, what, 7 or 8 U.S. presidents Castro has, I mean. So, and there is, of course, in many of the aspects of this story, the dysfunction is extraordinary to think that I think on his fifth attempt at escaping from Cuba, he was intercepted by a U.S. Coast Guard vessel. They took his autograph and made a big fuss over him, but they sent him back to Cuba. That is because of this peculiar law that unless you actually land with your feet wet on the shore, you can't get asylum.
The fact that we have a policy in this country known as wet foot, dry foot is just, you know, mind-boggling, right? As I was writing this, I was telling my son, he's in college, and explaining to him the story, and I mentioned wet foot, dry foot, and he said, is that real? Is that actually – that's our government rule? Like he said, it sounds like a kindergarten game, and it is. It's just – I mean it's bizarre on a couple different levels. On one hand, it gives Cubans – a huge advantage over other immigrants, right? It's a benefit that they receive that others don't. And, you know, ask some Haitians how they feel about wet foot, dry foot, and
right.
Certainly others throughout Latin America. It puts Cubans in a very favored status, and yet there's kind of a don't ask, don't tell quality to it as well. It's like, if you get here, we greet you with open arms. You're home free. But you know what? Don't tell us how you got here,
right.
And don't get caught while you're doing it.
There's an extra anomaly though. It's better that you go through a third country, right? Because then you can be up for the draft, right?
Right. Well, that's particularly true for baseball players, but I'm just thinking generally
sure.
For all Cubans.
Yeah, right.
The fact that you have to make it and you have to avoid being intercepted by the Coast Guard automatically is going to put you in the hands of a more sophisticated smuggling organization,
right.
Because you need to make it. If you're a baseball player and think you're worth many millions of dollars upon your arrival, then you need an even more sophisticated smuggling
right.
organization. And in this case, you need to go to a third country so that you can establish quote-unquote legal residency there, even though
right.
I think everyone knew that Yasiel Puig was not intending to, put down roots in Mexico. But then it allows him to negotiate with every possible baseball
right.
team.
Right, as a free agent. So he gets to this island. Oh, this is his fifth or sixth attempt to get out of the country. Obviously, he's had run-ins with the authorities. At one point, he actually snitched on other people that were trying to get out. And then he arrives in this little island off Cancun. He's in the hands of the guy that took him in the cigarette boat, has a shady past, right? He ends up dead. The people that kidnapped him then start negotiating with agents all around the country, and the clock is ticking like a taxi meter. Every minute that they don't pay up, it
right.
costs them an extra $100,000. So to walk us through the early parts of those negotiations.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much everyone has a shady past in this tale, so
right,
you got to be specific when you're talking about who has the shady past. But, right. you know, remember, this is all an economic equation. There are people in Miami, Cuban Americans, who see this as an investment, right? They are going to put up money in return for getting more down the road. And so these are kind of illicit financiers. And the guy who puts this in motion, shady past, he's an air conditioning repairman in his 20s who's on probation for attempting to steal air conditioners. So, it's the irony that this is the guy who could set this in motion is astonishing. But he puts up $250,000 to get Yasiel out of Cuba. In return,
not real money. It's a pledge, right?
Correct. He pledges to put up $250,000.
Right.
And in return, Yasiel is going to pay him 20% of his future earnings, which, you know, in this country would be considered an exploitive contract
right.
and usurious.
Right.
And
but Castro pays you $17 a month, right?
He was making $17 a month playing for a state-run baseball league. It sounded right. like a pretty good deal, especially
right.
if you think there's many more millions waiting for you after
right.
that.
Right.
And the smugglers who got him out of Cuba and took him to Isla Mujeres, if they had just been paid that $250,000, you and I probably wouldn't even be talking about this story right now
right.
because it would have just been, you know, a transaction, you move on, whatever, it's in the past. But the air conditioning repairman didn't have that $250,000. So for 20-some-odd days in the summer of 2012, Yasiel Puig and a few companions who were on that boat with him
Colorful companions.
Of course, they would have to be, right?
Right, a boxer and a stripper, right?
I don't know if she's a stripper, but she posts like very provocative pictures of herself on Facebook. And and don't forget that there's a Santeria priest who sprinkles a little chicken blood to bless their
right,
voyage.
So they're holed up in this little seedy motel while the phones are ringing and the negotiations are going on. But some of the people surrounding them have ties to Los Zetas, which are this very murderous Mexican drug cartel.
Yeah, absolutely. So the smugglers themselves are mostly Cuban-American. They're in the business of trafficking essentially their own people. And they are ticked off. They're very agitated because they've done the job. They want to get their 250 grand, and it's not there. And they're like, we don't play that game. You know, you need to pay us, and we'll do something horrible to Yasiel Puig if you don't pay us. But they also have their own problems because, yes, lurking in the background is the Zeta drug cartel. And these smugglers have to pay a tax to the Zetas, what they call a rite of passage. And one of the smugglers, in fact, sometime earlier, had been kidnapped himself by the Zetas and held hostage for ransom. And when they finally let him go, he was missing a pinky on one of his hands. So they got their own problems, you know, where they're answering to a higher authority in that area. And so the idea of pardoning this debt or just sort of shrugging it off as the cost of business, that wasn't really an option.
But then, well, let me again remind the audience that I'm speaking with Jesse Katz, who's a contributing writer at Los Angeles Magazine and the author of The Opposite Field, a former Los Angeles Times staff writer. He has earned numerous honors over a three-decade career, including two Pulitzer Prizes for Spot News Reporting and the Penn Center USA Award for Literary Journalism. His latest article, featured in Los Angeles Magazine, is Escape from Cuba, Yasiel Puig's Untold Journey to the Dodgers. So let's move to finally gets to Mexico City, and all of these big shots from the U.S. show up, right? The big agents, the representatives of the Dodgers, etc. And he's the kind of guy that the Dodgers are looking for, right? Because they've had this terrible slump and they've had this awful owner with his, you know, public spat with his awful, equally awful wife.
Right. Some of your listeners outside the L.A. area may not feel too much sympathy for us here in Dodgerland. There could be some schadenfreude out there. But, yeah, the Dodgers went through a really bleak period under Frank and Jamie McCourt, who sort of used the team as a personal ATM. And the organization almost collapsed. And, you know, this is an organization that has been a pioneer in terms of the internationalization of baseball. They were among the first clubs to really be out there in Latin America. Anyone who was in L.A. in the 1980s is going to remember Fernando Mania, the first great, you know, Mexican baseball player. And all that had come to an end. So the Dodgers had a couple things in mind. They were looking for great players. They suddenly had money to spend. And they also wanted to send a message throughout Latin America that they're back in business to all those young prospects, wherever they be, maybe Cuba, but also the Dominican Republic or wherever, that, you know, this is a club that's got deep pockets. And so they see Yasiel Puig. There's not much time to do a deal because there's some deadlines. The clock's ticking within, you know, baseball's own rules. And they decide they just need to make an offer that he can't refuse, and they propose 7 years, $42 million, which would be a record at the time for a Cuban defector. It's since been broken by another player who's on the White Sox right now. But everyone looked at the Dodgers like, what the heck are you guys doing? You're spending all this money. This is an unproven kid. He's barely played in Cuba. And
because he got into trouble with the authorities trying to get out of the country, right? So he was banned from local teams, et cetera.
Yeah, he had his – I mean, anyone who's familiar with his play today and some of his confounding antics and whether it's on the field or off the field will be, you know, perhaps comforted to know he was doing the same things back when he was in Cuba. He was kind of a problem child on the Cuban team, and he spent an entire season on the bench. I think more for not for any sort of political
For stealing sneakers in Holland, right?
Well, there was that. That was another episode. I mean, you know, he was kind of a headache, and yet he was enormously talented. But towards the end, as it became clear that he was trying to leave the island to come to the U.S. and be in the big leagues, then he was essentially kicked out of baseball in Cuba. Right. And it's odd because that's the punishment there. And yet it's also becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The minute the sports ministry in Cuba says you can't play for the Cuban team, they've essentially written, you know, the exit visa for that player. They're going to be gone.
Right, if they can. It's not – he tried five or six times. It's not apparently that easy to get out, but he did have this air conditioning repairman from Florida fronting his exit, and now we're in Mexico City. They make the deal with the Dodgers. Then they send him off to the farm in Arizona, right? And then he gets kind of Americanized by a guy that bonds with him.
Yeah, there's actually kind of a sweet moment in this story where the Dodgers have a director of a cultural assimilation, which is not a not a bad thing that they do. And he's a high school wrestling coach, and he's twice Puig's age, and he kind of takes him under his wing and teaches him all these very American, very capitalist, consumerist skills that he didn't have in Cuba, whether it was, reading a menu or, using an ATM card, pumping gas, whatever that might be. And you begin to see, Yasiel Puig had to rub shoulders with a lot of unsavory characters, right? He had to take enormous risks and make some compromises that weren't always honorable. And yet he gets here and suddenly you remember, oh, he's just a kid, He was 20 at the time, 21. And it was like having a newborn teenager almost. And he had to – he was wide-eyed and everything was sort of, wondrous to him. And you forget sometimes, when you see a celebrated figure like that with fame and fortune now, that just a couple of years ago he was a bewildered little kid.
So let's get into the more recent chapter where all of his past, and as you point out in your story in the Los Angeles magazine, Escape from Cuba, Yasiel Puig's untold journey to the Dodgers. You yourself had a hard time getting interviews with him. He obviously didn't want to talk to the press. But meanwhile, all of those shady people from his past who got him out, who pledged money and didn't pay up and et cetera, they're all sort of fighting over their cut right from this guy. And the boxer that he got out of the country with, who set up in a business, a Santeria business that fails, right? He then turns on his best friend. So let's go into the machinations then of everybody wanting a cut from this brilliant young Cuban player.
Yeah. So when he left Isla Mujeres, he was rescued from there. He escaped from the clutches of the smugglers, and as I mentioned, that's not a debt that they're going to let go. So they came looking for him. He had already signed this contract. He was in the Dodgers organization, and they wanted to track him down to get paid. And it was easier to track down the boxer, this guy Junior de Spain, who was on the boat with him. And they threatened him. They confronted him. They stuck a gun in his ribs, and they said, tell Yasiel he needs to pay, or we're going to kill him. They called Junior's mother back in Cuba, said, where does Yasiel Puig live? Where's his family? We're gonna burn down his house. And if you don't tell us, we're going to come burn down your house too. I mean, this is like, serious business. These are people who don't resolve their disputes in a court of law. They, handle it.
They don't go to small claims. They kneecap you, right?
They handle it themselves. And so in the midst of this, Junior, who, was Puig's friend and acquaintance through the sports leagues in Cuba, from the same part of Cuba, Cienfuegos, who had endured this harrowing journey with him and survived this captivity, suddenly is feeling like, he's taking the brunt of this. Yasiel hasn't cleaned up after himself, and Junior's, paying for it. And at a certain point, he begins to cooperate with some lawyers who are suing Yasiel in federal court in Miami. And it's a little separate, a little distinct from the story we're talking about here, but it gets back to that idea of escaping from the island and the fact that Yasiel was an informant at least once, possibly more times, that he testified against the fellow who had allegedly offered him a trip off the island. And this guy was sentenced to 7 years in prison. And,
in Cuba, right?
In Cuba. Mm-hmm. It's all really troubling stuff. It's sort of troubling that having a discussion about leaving the island is a crime. And it's troubling that Yasiel testified against this guy and, has to take some responsibility for him being in prison. And, you know, it's troubling that there's just a system that makes people have to make those kind of impossible choices. Anyway, this guy who was sentenced is suing Yasiel in a U.S. court in Florida under some Victims of Torture, you know, international conventions, saying that Yasiel conspired with the Cuban government to, you know, inflict all sorts of horrors on him, and is seeking $12 million. Hard to say that it doesn't look like kind of a shakedown, but, you know, fair enough. They'll have their day in court. But now Junior is cooperating with those lawyers. So even though Junior's not part of the snitch thing, it's really, you know, he's providing some very vivid allegations that kind of give credibility to the plaintiff in that case and of course embarrass Yasiel. And in doing that, he's betraying his friend. And but he's also giving us like our first glimpse of what really happened. Had Junior Despain not submitted an affidavit laying out this kind of blueprint of the journey, I'm not sure that any of us would have ever learned what happened on that boat or in that motel.
Well, but there is there's a body in this, isn't there? It's the dead guy, the guy that took him in the cigarette boat from Cuba to Mexico, ends up shot, 13 times in the back?
Of course there's a body in this, yeah, right?
Right. So how does that tie into the story just as we wrap up here?
Yeah, well, you know, as Junior is feeling threatened there in Miami, these guys are coming to him with sticking guns in his ribs. He contacts Yasiel and says, do something about this, brother. Clean up your mess. And Yasiel contacts then one of the other financiers who helped put this in motion. And this guy allegedly says, well, we're going to neutralize the problem. We're going to neutralize the smuggler named Leo. And sure enough, a month later, Leo's bullet-riddled body turns up on a street in Cancun. I should say very clearly there's no evidence linking Yasiel or his people to this murder. It's kind of weird that one of these guys wanted to take credit for that, but maybe that's the bravado and the bluster that you need to survive in that murky world. But nobody was ever arrested or prosecuted for that crime.
So your article then is out in the Los Angeles magazine that goes on the stands tomorrow, right?
Yes, it's the May issue of LA Magazine. It's been online for the last week at lamag.com. And one cool thing, we did it in English and in Spanish. It's the first time LA Magazine has published a story instantly translated into Spanish.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you. It's a nice, refreshing break from depressing international relations agonies.
So. Well, this is depressing international relations too, but it's colorful.
It's colorful. And again, I thank Jesse Katz, who's a contributing writer at Los Angeles Magazine and the author of The Opposite Field. He's a former Los Angeles Times staff writer, and he's earned numerous honors over a three-decade career, including two Pulitzer Prizes for Spot News reporting and the Penn Center USA Award for Literary Journalism. His latest article in Los Angeles Magazine is Escape from Cuba, Yasiel Puig's Untold Journey to the Dodgers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.